This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This morning, Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke joined us live here on WUTC. Chattanooga made national news this week due to the impact of COVID-19 on our city and our corner of the Southeast. We talked about that, among other topics, via Zoom during our monthly conversation with the mayor. First thing I wanted to ask you is remind us where we stand now with the reopening of some city facilities this week.
So we started reopening to the public. Much of our office workers are still working from their homes, but we have started to open up facilities for public use. Our library got limited computer access and curbside delivery for books. That has been working extremely well, is my understanding. And so we're going to keep looking at this. The most important thing for me is to keep our employees and our constituents safe, and we're going to keep that at the forefront.
And of course, you are following the procedures that you called for early on during this pandemic. But again, just a reminder for the folks who might be interacting with city agencies this week.
That's right. We're following them. We've installed a bunch of protective equipment. Everybody has to wear a mask when dealing with us. If you don't want to wear a mask, that's fine. Just transact your business online.
The coverage of us, Chattanooga, in the national news. I'm talking, of course, about the story from NBC News in which you were quoted. The story from NBC News this week pointing to the reopening of businesses in late April, the lack of social distancing and mask use, and the difficulty in contact tracing leading to the increases in cases now. One quote above all others stood out for me from the reporter for that piece. This city, like so many others in the South, has the makings of a hotspot. We now have a mask mandate going into effect soon in Hamilton County. You called for that early on and for a slower reopening. What do you say to people who hear about the mandate now and say it's too little, too late? Look at the numbers surging.
Well, it's never too late. We always can take action and prevent more spread. The numbers are extremely difficult for us, but that's the reason that it is more important than ever to obey the basic rules that you're talking about, staying 6 feet away from others, not congregating in large groups, and wearing a mask, washing hands. I think that I would just point out two things. One is wearing a mask is really important. It cuts about a third of the transmission rate. But number two is that's not the only thing. It's just one component. Just like testing isn't the only thing, wearing a mask isn't the only thing. And so if you wear a mask, but you're standing right next to somebody else for hour upon hour a day, you're reducing the spread, the possibility of spread, but that doesn't send it to zero. And so still maintain distance.
Another piece of this, of course, is once you have a mask mandate, trying to enforce it, and a lot easier said than done, given some of the questions that Sheriff Hammond had to field once the mandate was announced.
Enforcing it is difficult. However, most people want to comply. And if you move from a situation where whatever the number is, 30% of the people are wearing a mask to a point where 70 or 80 or 90% of the people are wearing a mask, you've moved the needle. Now, nothing that we do gets 100% compliance. We have speeding restrictions on roads. We can't enforce those 100%. We tell people not to text and drive. Unfortunately, we don't have that at 100%. What you do is get the most people that you can, and then for the rest, work on compliance, hopefully through voluntary methods.
And one of the things that also stood out from the NBC News piece, fewer than 10% of Tennesseans complying with a mask. That's a challenge, too, even though folks, including medical experts are calling on Governor Lee to issue a statewide mask mandate.
It's something for us to think about, that we don't live in isolation from anybody. We don't live in isolation from our neighbors in Georgia, if you're a Tennessee resident. If you're a Hamilton County resident, we don't live in isolation from Marion County or Reid County or any of the counties that surround us. And so the reality is that we need to have clear guidance that allows people to understand what the best rules are. And right now we're living in a world where there's lots of back and forth about this, about the politics of this, when the science is settled. And so if we just start listening to experts, obeying the common sense rules that they put down, like they have in many other countries, we can get through this.
We're still dealing with a patchwork of policies, as you referred to there, with counties outside of Hamilton County and also going down into Georgia. And we've seen the numbers shooting up all around us as well.
We are. And if you look at the capacity of our hospitals and ICUs, they are greatly affected by not just Hamilton County residents, but we know that Memorial, Erlanger, and Park Ridge are all part of a regional network, and people come from all around to go to those hospitals. And if they get overloaded, it isn't just going to be because of Chattanooga people, it's going to be because of the entire region.
And we're also seeing something similar now in terms of the spread of this. The Hispanic community here has been hit the hardest, among those hit the hardest, but infections are spreading well beyond that community at this point.
They are. We've spent a lot of time and energy trying to get the word out to people in the Latinx community to say, here are the best ways that you can keep yourself and your family safe. There have been huge challenges. As you look at the Latinx numbers, even though they've been declining, they're about 6% or so of our county. And at one point, they were making up roughly 68% of our cases. I think yesterday, that number had declined down to a little bit over 50%. There's good news in that, and that we've made progress with that community. The bad news is one of the reasons the percentage is going down is because the percentage in other populations is rising.
What are you hearing from the medical professionals and others who are on the front lines of this, whether it's reaching out and responding to the cases in the Hispanic community, the other hard-hit communities, or the community in general? What are you hearing from these folks at this time?
Well, we obviously keep in close contact. We have a weekly meeting, Mayor Coppinger and I do, with the COVID-19 task force. We know that that the resources are becoming more strained. As we were discussing earlier, it goes even beyond our region because, of course, when testing or other supplies are needed in other areas like Arizona or Texas or Florida because of huge outbreaks, that affects our ability to get these supplies that we need. And so if it's a drug that you need for treatment and the treatment has improved for people with coronavirus, we don't want to get to a point where we lack all those. So I think people in the medical community are concerned. You've heard a lot of advocacy for the mask mandate. And again, most of the projections have been that we're going to see the numbers continue to creep up unless we have some kind of intervention that is effective.
Another indicator in all this and trying to get a handle on all this is the sewage study that the city of Chattanooga participated in with BioDot Analytics. Tell us more about that, and were you surprised by the results?
Well, what we did was we partnered with this group, and what it showed us was that at the beginning of May and the first few weeks of May, we had very little COVID in our wastewater, and you can actually tell what kind of infections you're seeing through the wastewater. And then starting in the middle of May for the next several weeks, it rose substantially. This is of concern, and it, at least to some extent, confirms what most experts are saying, which is that probably for every person who tests positive, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think the CDC says 10 cases of people who have COVID who don't get tested and test positive. Other experts are saying it's more like 11 or 12. So we're seeing that because we see substantially increasing COVID in the wastewater.
And all this has unfolded in this back and forth between public health and the economy. Politics have come up in the middle of this. Another thing that stood out from the reporting this week, the $2.5 million set aside for small businesses while things were shut down in the past few months, that money's been spent. And if we have more surging, if we have a second wave, not to say that we're out of this first wave, if we're going to call it that, we're in a world of hurt as far as not only the public health impact, but also the economic impact here in Chattanooga and Hamilton County.
I believe that the public health and the economic ramifications go hand in hand. You've certainly seen that in Sweden, where they had many worse public health results because they chose not to intervene, and their economy actually has been worse than other countries around them. But if we don't get a handle on the public health piece here, we risk our businesses and the hard work that they put in. One of the things that I know is that as these businesses reopened after the shutdown, many people put their life savings into the businesses so that they could get them back working again. I do not want to betray their trust. I want them to continue to operate, to employ people around our community. These small business owners are critical for our economic development. And if we have a second wave, they won't necessarily have that kind of backstop to reopen when it's over.
I wanted to shift gears here to the city council's action last night. Two-thirds of the members declaring racism as a public health crisis. Do you see racism as a public health crisis in the wake of George Floyd and the protests, including the calls from protesters here in Chattanooga?
Yes, I think this is a great way to think about the issues that we see, the systemic ramifications of racism. I was born in Chattanooga, have lived virtually my whole life here. And as a Southerner, we know that we're the birthplace of slavery. We're the place of Jim Crow. And we live with the legacy of that. And it is incumbent on each of us to dismantle any systemic racism that exists. I think it's wonderful that that these issues are being brought to the fore and that it keeps the top of mind issue for all of us as we deal with this issue that affects the lives of so many people in our community.
This brings me back to the protests here in Chattanooga and the budget that was recently passed and your push to create an Office of Community Resilience. There were protesters that were not satisfied with that. They were not satisfied with the dollar amount. They were critical of the amount as far as that actually being a down payment to attack some of these very disparities we've been talking about here in the past half hour.
Yes. What I wanted to do is to set up a mechanism for us to continue to tackle these problems. Our police department has been examining this issue for several years. When I came in, one of the things that we wanted to do was to ensure that we had the right policies, and hired Chief Fletcher, who took a hard look at this. And so when you started seeing the movement to change police policies across the country, we already had virtually all those policies in place. And that's a good thing. We've seen that in our numbers. We've seen that in our relationship with the community. All that is good. I still believe that there are ways that we can look at our police department and find things that officers themselves do not want to do, that they would love for somebody more qualified to do. But I'm also old enough to remember when people complained that they would call 911 and that nobody would answer the call in communities of color. This was a huge problem in the 1980s. I will not let people go without services. And so the only way for me to feel good about changing the way dollars are allocated is to know that the services that are needed are replaced, because traditionally, when you cut government funding, the places that feel it the worst are communities of color and low-income communities. And I will not be part of that.
Another thing that they have talked about in the protests is a more participatory budget process. What are your thoughts on that as you are wrapping up your final months of office and given the budget that was just passed? Is there room for an approach like that or something similar?
Well, we already have a participatory process, and we welcome more people to do this. So when I came in, we started budgeting for outcomes, which is all about making sure that we prioritize the things that are most important to our community and make sure that they are effective in our budgeting. The second piece that we started doing was to allow residents of the community to participate in the process. So every year, as part of everything that is funded in the budget, has what we call an offer. And those offers are rated by teams that include people from the community. That's not just from city government things. So every part of our our budget have been reviewed by people from the community. On top of that, we hold budgeting sessions that are attended by members of the community. We have process to submit comments online. We summarize all those in memo form for people in the community. And so I think the members of the public participating in the budget is essential for us to have the budget that we want.
When we're talking about dealing with systemic disparities, are the stakeholders in the community beyond government? And I'm thinking of that because, of course, Unum just announced the creation of a social justice fund. Where do you see stakeholders in this community needing to go to tackle these disparities beyond the one announcement yesterday from Unum?
Well, I certainly appreciate Unum stepping up as a corporate partner and saying that they want to tackle these issues. I think it makes a statement, not just for them, but about what private industries need to be doing all across our region. I think, as we said earlier, it's about keeping this top of mind. Systemic means it's everywhere. And certainly government is a place where people are rightly focused. But most of our economy, most of the things that happen come through the private sector. And making sure that we are dismantling racism and enabling opportunity for all across every sector of our community is important. I think that that's the discussion that we're having. And while it started with police, it's a good thing for us to figure out how to make sure that we're looking at this in every sector. So, you know, if you think about the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century was defined by the way that we ensured that women were a bigger part of the workforce and began the process of having more equality for blacks and other people of color in the American economy. And so for African Americans and women and other people to participate more fully, it allows us to show greater economic development and more prosperity for all. That's what we want. And this is not a zero-sum situation. When people of color and those who've been kept out of the process are able to participate more fully, that's helpful for everybody.
And as we wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about something that you announced last week, one small piece in trying to attack these systemic disparities, the city receiving a grant to focus on predatory lending.
Yeah, predatory lending attacks communities of color and attacks low-income people in a greater way than many problems that we have. It keeps people in a cycle of high interest rates. We need to stop that. We received a grant from the Annie E. Casey Foundation and I want to continue to work to publicize the ways that predatory lending affects people and how to find other solutions. Financial empowerment is something that allows Chattanooga residents to live the life that they want, to have more control over their lives. And when you're stuck in a cycle with a predatory lender, you can never get there.
And then as far as how people can best contact the city, best find out information online, they may know it, they may hear it all the time, but always good, I think, when we have a longer conversation like this, Mr. Mayor, to hit those points.
Yeah, well, you can certainly go to our website, which is Chattanooga.gov. I'm on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram. You can see us there. You can always email me at mayor@chattanooga.gov. The phone number is, my phone number is 423-643-7800. But in reality, the best thing that you can do if you need immediate assistance is to either dial 311 or to go to the Chat 311 app, because many of the services that people need are readily available there.
All right. Mayor Andy Burke, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Author Vitris Conley is hosting a live conversation online tonight with fellow Black female authors in the Chattanooga area. The conversation, called Ready, Set, Write, a girlfriend chat about writing your first book, begins at 9 p.m. on Facebook Live. Vitris joins us here, along with the authors participating in tonight's conversation, Keosha Brewster, Amber Woodruff, and Jessica Greer.
Vitris, Keosha, Amber, Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Ray.
So, Vitris, tell us more about this virtual gathering.
Well, Ray, I am hosting a panel discussion involving three new authors here in the Chattanooga area, and we are going to be discussing just the motivation and how to get encouraged to write your first book. So what you would say, it's going to be like a sister chat or a girlfriend chat is what I've called it on the flyer. But all of these three women have mastered and written, publish and launch their first book. And I'm so excited for all three of these women. I worked directly with all three of them and closely with them to help them just have that motivation and extra push to get their manuscript out there. I'm excited to say that all three women accepted that challenge and they did it. So what I want to do with this panel discussion is just motivate and inspire and most of all educate other women and also men that you can have the desire and the motivation to write and to do it and to put it in action. All three of these women have done that and done it successfully, and I want them to be able to share their story.
Well, let's talk about each of those stories right now, starting with you, Kiosha. Tell us more about your journey as an author.
My book is called Chasing Him, and it is about my journey with domestic violence and how I overcame that and what that looks like for me. So this has been extremely exciting. I always knew I wanted to write a book, and I thank God for Beatrice doing this for me to be able to have somebody walk with me through it. But it was exciting. It was challenging. It was therapeutic. But having the finished product is like a dream come true.
And Amber, how about you?
My book is called Struggling Butterfly, and it is a personal book about my current 20s, I guess you would say, or my late 20s. So it's a combination of journal entries and tips to help with like dating and anxiety and things of that nature. And I am also grateful for her doing this program or the workshop to help, because I had been sitting on this book for a while. And I lacked the motivation to like piece it all together and kind of like force myself to sit down. And she helped me do that and still in the way that I needed, because I'm very organized and I needed structure. So she was able to like meet me halfway and give me the extra push that I needed. So yeah, that's pretty much my journey. Like I said, I had it for a while, but I needed the extra encouragement and the extra organization, and she brought that, and it's been out for about a month and a half now, and it's been great. So I am completely grateful for her help and her coaching.
And Jessica, how about your journey?
My journey, I know that at the end of last year, I knew I wanted to write a book. And at that time, I wrote it down in a book of goals, and it was just a simple thought. And then I was recommended to reach out to Beatrice, and I started working with her closely. And my book is The Blessing in Every Lesson, A Reflective Guide on the Road to Self-Love and Spiritual Riches. So it's funny that I was kind of still dealing with some issues with love while I was working closely with Beatrice. And she actually pushed me even on a personal side as well as a professional side. And I'm really, really appreciative of her, because she helped my dream literally come true.
Your journeys as authors, you're talking about the personal and the creative. Each of you has had very difficult things to deal with.
Yes, I ran into that while like writing the book, I guess, because it is a memoir or a personal experience, and you want to give the full disclosure part of the book, and you're not never sure like how much to exactly like put in or how personal do you want it to be, because once it's out there, you can't take it back from the public. So we talked a lot about that, and she helped me be vulnerable in writing and knowing that, of course, you have control of what you put in it. And the only way to really help yourself and others through writing is to be as transparent as possible. So, but having creative control and freedom in writing, period, like Jessica said, you kind of relive it, or you're going through it as you write. And I think that's what makes a book a good book anyway, is when you put your whole self in it. And it's just an extra bonus when you, I don't know, when you give kind of like everything, or if you have to experience it while you're writing. So it's kind of therapeutic for both the reader and the writer.
Exactly. I agree. For me, my life and my story has been the journey, but writing the book has been the journey as well. And I speak specifically about self-reflection, because during my whole process while I'm writing, I'm actually reflecting on my life, where I am now, and bringing out some of the old stuff to understand myself. And that's what it's all about for me, self-love. And hopefully with the goal in mind of reaching other people to do the same thing, to focus on self and loving self and understanding that we are all great. We all human beings. We go through things, but we can come out of it.
And Beatrice, you talked about this as an opportunity to motivate and inspire. And if there's ever a time where we need motivation and inspiration, it's now. How much does it mean to you and to the fellow authors here to be having this event online at this time with everything that has happened in just a matter of months?
I think it's super critical, and it's also intentional because all three of these women have written, published, and launched their book during this pandemic, and they all had that opportunity during these past months to actually have that quiet time and that self-reflection in order to do this. Something that they had all been dreaming about and had written down as goals for some time. So I think that what we can learn from all three of them and what I've learned from working with them is that you can do whatever you set your mind to. And during this time, just having that extra additive time to pursue your dreams is so much more critical now than ever. And I'm so proud of all three of them for doing that and showing that it can be done.
Agreed. Because at first, I didn't think that this was like the right time to be doing something like this during the pandemic. But at the same time, like, I didn't want to sit idle with like a bunch of free time and like not be as productive as I could. And then, I mean, I had a list going into 2020. No one really expected this year to go like this at all, but I didn't really want that to like defer a lot of goals or whatever. So it was kind of like a bad and good thing, but it's been way more than I would have ever imagined, I think, with or without the pandemic. So it's just about using time wisely.
For me, it was no better time than now. Depression, anxiety, like all of those things, I know just from people in my circle going in and overdrive now during this time with the isolation or the lack of human contact. So taking the time to get in tune with self and love self more is very important, because I was that person who was on medication for depression and anxiety. And my book, it was healing for me, very healing. I'm no longer on the medication. And I feel like this is the best time for everyone to take out the time to not just study self, but write. Like, writing is therapeutic. And I feel like everyone has a story that they can share. And I think this is a great time to do it.
This was an amazing time to do this. I'm almost certain that even though I had already started writing, I'm certain that if this time wouldn't have existed with pandemic, that I would not have written my book as soon as I did. This gave me an opportunity for the world to slow down, and a lot of my responsibilities went away. And so I was able to focus on this solely and make sure it was what I wanted it to look like. And also, I accept the challenge of launching a book during this time, just to show how resilient that we really are. Also to show to other people that life does go on. This is not the end of life. And so we should stay creative. We should stay productive, even though it seems like the world around us is changing a lot, and it is. Some parts of us will always be the same. We'll always be creative. We'll always be resilient. We'll always be moving forward. And so I felt like this time was perfect for me to do this project.
Also, an especially important time to do this project and to share, not only as authors, but as Black women.
Especially, yes. And I think just piggybacking off what Keosha said, they're resilient. And knowing that with everything going on and how strong that we all are, we've taken it to that next level and said we're resilient and we won't stop. We'll keep going and we'll keep pushing, not only for ourselves, but for other Black women, for our children, for our men, for our families. We are always held as the one that keeps everything together in our families and in our communities. And I think that being authors is just another responsibility in telling our stories, telling her story, that's even more important as well. So definitely during this time, with everything going on with the pandemic and also with everything else going on in our world today, very, very important.
And Vitris, where can people go online to participate?
So the panel discussion will take place tonight on my Facebook page, which is Arthur Beatrice Conley. It will air at 9 p.m. The name of the panel discussion is Ready, Set, Write, and it's a girlfriend chat about writing your first book. And all three of these women will be a part of the panel discussion. We will be talking more just about the inspiration, the motivation, and the dedication of writing your first book. We would love for everyone to join in on the discussion.
All right. Vitris, Kiosha, Amber, Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks for your support.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.